King of the Goblins is the guy who gets you when you just need to get it done. You don't want any no frills, just get it done.
You don't understand, so I'm going to kick you in the spleen until it pops. Get it done, Goblin King, get it done, yeah!
There should be a bit in this where he sort of passes Gabriel Grubby's card and it just says, King of the Goblins, getting it done. Hello and welcome to Shark Liver Oil. I hope you've had a good Christmas and I hope you're looking forward to a happy new year. And this is going to be a little sort of mini Christmas extra. It's quite a short episode this week. We're going to do The Goblins Who Stole a Sexton, which is a Charles Dickens story, a short story, which is kind of seen as a spiritual father, if you like, of a Christmas carol, which we've obviously spent the Christmas season doing. I'm Matt. And, well, The Goblins Who Stole a Sexton. It's come a bit out of left field, this, because we didn't really preview it or anything. But what did you... Just in general, David, had you ever heard of it before?
No, I never had. I quite love that we've gone from probably the most well-known Charles Dickens short story to probably the least well-known Charles Dickens short story. I thought it was really good. And again, this is all part of me kind of giving Charles Dickens another sort of crack of the whip, having tried to start David Copperfield about 9 times and failed. So this is me and Charlie starting again.
No, it's often not really a stunner as a standalone story. It's one of the stories told in a book called The Pickwick Papers. Mm. So it's sort of a story within a story, but it's been relatively recently, I suppose, marketed as a story in its own right.
Mm. Well, which makes sense, doesn't it? Because Pickwick Papers is one of the many novels that Charles Dickens wrote in instalments for newspapers. So in a sense, sort of treating them as novels is a little bit weird, because what they actually are is like collections of serials.
Yeah. So The Goblins Who Stole a Sexton. And so this is about a... see if you can see the parallel here. A miserable old man who hates Christmas, who is just has nothing but contempt for all the joy and festivities around him as he's going about his business. This guy isn't called Ebenezer Scrooge, he's called Gabriel Grubb, which is a cracking name.
Isn't it brilliant? I'm really starting to enjoy Charles Dickens's way with a name. You know what I mean? Like, you come up with something as good as Fezziwig and you put it in as a minor character just because that's the wealth of crazy-ass names that you come up with every day. Just imagine him walking down the street going, Fezziwig and Blumpty-Bum and Flingledash, and I'm going to use them all.
Yeah, Jeremiah Picklesworth.
Exactly, Jeremiah Picklesworth, honestly.
So yeah,
and
this
Gabriel
guy,
Grubb.
Yeah, he's described as a morose and lonely man. He's a sexton, basically a grave digger. That's basically his job, isn't it? And he spends his days digging graves, unsurprisingly. he sees all the sort of all the festivities and good cheer around him for Christmas. And it says, all this was gall and wormwood to the heart of Gabriel Grubb. And when groups of children bounded out of the houses, tripped across the road, and were met before they could knock at the opposite door by half a dozen curly-haired little rascals who crowded round them as they flocked upstairs to spend the evening in the Christmas games, Gabriel smiled grimly and clutched the handle of his spade with a firmer grasp. And he thought of measles, scarlet fever, thrush, whooping cough, and a good many other sources of consolation besides. So basically... wishing all these ailments on the happy children at Christmas.
And the thing is that, as well as being a great line, that was kind of like, that was a bit of a relief to me to read that. Because when I read, he clutched the spade tighter, I was like, geez, are you going to start clubbing children? Is this like Ebenezer Scrooge, but postal? I was a bit like, where are you going with this, Charlie?
Well, he kind of does. Because shortly after that, he's on his way to the graveyard to dig a grave, as he does, and he takes this back alley, which he likes to go down because it's so dark and forbidding that no one else ever goes there.
He liked darkness. Darkness was cheap. That's the thing, isn't it? Yeah. He always likes, the hero of this type of character story always likes going through dark areas.
Yeah. So he's walking down, but his enjoyment of the dank, dark, and miserable alley is ruined by this young urchin who's come scampering down the alley, singing away. So Grub grabs this young lad, smacks him over the head with a lantern, and he says, the young urchin runs off crying a different sort of tune, and Grubbs thoroughly enjoys that. So it's sort of one in the eye for the celebrating children there as well.
Yeah, one in the eye for children everywhere who have the innocence to skip down darkened alleys singing at the top of their lungs. Because I was going to say about this, imagine, I don't know about you, but in my childhood, if there were darkened alleys, you stayed away from them, you didn't take them as shortcuts and sing in your loud voice while you were going down them. But yeah. Clearly, back then, it was a bad idea as well.
Yeah, well, he was asking for trouble, and he found it in the shape of Gabriel Grubb.
Well, that's something, I don't think he was asking for trouble. I just think he was unlucky to be born on the same planet as Gabriel Grubb.
So Grubb gets to the graveyard, starts digging his grave, and he has this little sort of poem, or I don't know if it might even be a song. He just sort of murmurs it, so it's more of a poem. And it says sort of, brave lodgings for one, brave lodgings for one, a few feet of cold earth when life is done. And it goes on. He's just reveling in the crushing certainty of death for everybody, isn't he?
I could not have put it better myself, and how awful. And I mean, obviously he's being sketched as a grotesque character, but it's still like, kind of, who sings songs about the fact that everybody's going to die?
Yeah.
And there's a bit of me that, like, my image of Victorian England is so kind of gothic that I'm a little bit like, do you reckon this was actually a song? Do you reckon there was actually a song about how we're all definitely going to die?
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, Ring Around the
Roses.
Well,
me neither. Isn't that so? Drawing on our knowledge of England and kind of inheriting this whole cultural norm, neither of us in the slightest bit surprised to discover that there is such a thing as a song about how death is inevitable and nothing means anything.
Well, quite. And he loves, Grubb loves this, he has a good little laugh at a coffin at Christmas, a Christmas box. Ho, 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 ho. Oh. And as he's laughing,
so lame. Sorry, yeah, carry on.
Yeah. As he's laughing, his laugh is mimicked from behind him by this voice which goes, ho, ho, ho. And you're thinking, Father Christmas is about to turn.
Exactly, isn't it? And I wonder if that was a cliche back then, that Father Christmas went, ho, 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 ho. Or if this is just a great coincidence.
Turns out it's not Father Christmas, it's a goblin. And it's the description of this goblin is brilliant. It's got really long, fantastic legs, apparently. His hands rested on them. His sinewy arms were bare. Rested his hands on his knees. He was short, round body, close covering, ornamented with small slashes, short cloak, a collar. It's a really strange... I mean, it's not your typical sort of Tolkien goblin, is it?
I was going to say that, actually. Well, what it sounds more like to me is kind of like Gollum when he's let himself go a bit, I think is what I think of when I hear this. Do you know what I mean?
I was thinking of a sort of a gentleman goblin in sort of a, almost like a top hat and tails without the top hat.
Oh, that would be incredible. Can you imagine a goblin, but the upper crust of goblin, a better sort of goblin.
Yeah. This guy, for his fairly strange appearance, obviously is terrifying, and Gabriel Grubb is petrified. And he's trying to say, you're a figment of my imagination, and the goblin's like, no, I'm not.
He doesn't try and make a very complicated argument there, does he? He's like, I'm imagining you, and he's like, bet you're fucking not.
Yeah. And he starts this menacing line of questioning the goblin, where he asks these various questions about, you know, who would be out digging a grave on a night like this at Christmas? And these are the voices around start going, Gabriel Grubb, Gabriel Grubb. And it's like Grubb's thinking, this is starting to escalate. I don't like where this is going.
Like, if they'd have had such phraseology as this shit is getting proper freaky and no mistake back then, that's exactly what he would have been like.
Yeah.
And I don't like it.
And the goblin sort of goes on like this for a while, and he sort of leers at the sexton. And he says, I find it really creepy because I always find this kind of thing all the more menacing than something that just comes at you and is obviously menacing.
Yeah.
This sort of approach of, well, you know, it's nothing personal, but, you know, you're out here on your own digging a grave at Christmas means you're a fair price for my boys. So it's going to have to, and it's sort of, it's almost a commiseratory, but I'm still going to put you through something dreadful to get ready for
Yeah, it is that, isn't it? It's that sort of like, now I'm not a pantomime beast, even though a goblin is exactly what a pantomime beast is.
Yeah.
But he's kind of almost being reasonable, you know?
Yeah. He says, I'm afraid my friends want you, Gabriel. And then the rest of the goblins appear to the sound of an organ playing in the church. And they start leapfrogging over gravestones, like some. It's like it's also all goes a bit Cirque du Soleil.
That's amazing, a gothic Cirque du Soleil.
And the leader, who's the guy who's been speaking, the king of the goblins, leaps over the biggest. You know, he leaps over whole crypts and stuff. And they drag Gabriel down into the lair of the goblins. Yeah, it's such a fantastic, it's just such a weird story, isn't it? Just like
it doesn't fuck around, does it? And I'm a bit curious. I didn't have time to look at this, but I'm a bit curious as to how this fits into the context of the Pickwick Papers, which I had always previously thought of as quite a, oh, not stuffy, but you know, I don't know, the Pickwick Papers, the papers of the Pickwick Society, blah, 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 blah. You know, all frock coats and top hats and that. And then there's this story in the middle of that, a fella who digs graves for a living being picked on by imaginary goblins. That's out of left field. That's like getting to a really tenderly written romantic love scene from Elizabethan England in the middle of a Tom Clancy novel. It's just, what? What's going on here?
So they're in the lair, and and the lead, sort of king of the goblins, says it's cold tonight, needs something to warm us up. And they all start drinking this, what effectively seems to be a goblet of liquid fire. And they force it down Gabriel's throat as well. I mean, that's what you call a goblet of fire. Forget about it, Harry Potter. Go eat at the kids' table. This is a goblet of fire.
Best thing is, I can just imagine your face when you read that. You were like, yeah, goblet of fire. Get fucking written down there.
So after he's taken this drink, which obviously, unsurprisingly, feels like it's burning its way. It sounds like the sort of strongest whiskey you could have, something like that. It burns its way into his stomach. And then the goblins show him this vision. It's a series of visions. And the first one is this sort of idealized, happy family, where there's a family all around with kids. And it's a really happy and warm scene. And then a bit later on, one of the sons dies, and there's this sadness, but this togetherness as well. And then it shifts forward again, and it shows sort of this mother and father as an older, really old couple, but they're still surrounded by loved ones, and the man dies, and shortly after, his wife dies as well, and they're laid to rest, and the children carry on. And it's this general sort of just the beauty of a quiet and peaceful existence, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's this, I just find it amazing that this, that the format Charles Dickens chooses for this is a short story, you know, instead of making it like a whole novel, you know, where you really see the heft and weight of the human lives that Gabriel Grubb is completely ignoring. He just bashes it out in two paragraphs.
Never mind your three spirits.
Never mind your three spirits. Never mind your three-volume novel, which was very popular at the time. Fuck it. Goblins. Creepy shit. Page 2.
Yeah. King of the Goblins is the guy who gets you when you just need to get it done. You don't want any no-frills. Just get it done.
So are we imagining we're back in the waiting room, aren't we, where they're all clocking in and clocking out? There's the Ghost of Christmas Past, Present and Future all sitting around scratching themselves, being a little bit lazy. And then it's kind of like, he's coming, he's coming. Door slams open, King of the Goblins walks through. Dun, 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 dun. Like, everybody's like, yeah, you're the man, you're the man. His hair's kind of blowing in the wind. Get it done, Goblin King, get it done, yeah.
It should be a bit in this where he sort of passes Gabriel Grubby's card and he just says, King of the Goblins, getting it done.
Yeah, exactly. Brilliant, that's exactly what I want.
So the goblin shows him this vision and then says, you know, what do you think of that? And Gabriel's like, yeah, yeah, it's very nice. And he's like, you don't understand enough. And he starts kicking him.
And yeah. Then, oh, man, this bit was just ridiculous. Like, it was, I mean, so this is not Kafka, I don't think. I think it's after Kafka, before, slightly before Kafka. But it's that sort of like somebody in a position of power being totally illogically vicious towards you.
Yeah.
Just like, it's the worst. It's like a school nightmare, isn't it? You don't understand, so I'm going to kick you in the spleen until it pops.
Yeah. And this is really interesting as compared to the Christmas Carol, because that's quite a sudden departure, where the because the spirits are obviously are helpful but and show things that are difficult to Scrooge, but they are obviously well-meaning and do him no harm. And I think the goblin generally is sort of, I suppose, kind of well-meaning. He's trying to change this guy's ways. But he's not.
Yeah, but he's having a certain amount of fun with it, isn't he? He's like, yeah. So like sort of a reformed football hooligan from the early 80s is what it is, isn't it?
Yeah. And this brings us to this part of the book is, I think that this was the thing that I thought was most prescient about it, and a really interesting point and quite a good comment that still holds up to today, where the King of the Goblins kicks him and then everybody else joins him, and he says, the King of the Goblins administered a good sound kick to Gabriel Grubb, immediately after which all the goblins in waiting crowded round the wretched sexton and kicked him without mercy, according to
got involved.
Yeah, according to the established and invariable custom of courtiers upon earth, who kick whom royalty kicks and hug whom royalty hugs.
And
it's this kind of sheep mentality. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I like it because, you know, he can even make kind of goblins picking on a human being into a sort of, you know, into a kind of satire on what people are like, on what human beings are like.
Yeah, and it's really true, that, isn't it? More often than not, all it takes is more likely than not now, a celebrity to sort of have a, you know, be outraged about something, and suddenly everybody else is outraged about it as well.
Oh, it must be outraging. The Katie Price said so. Do you know what I mean? It's like very, very kind of dubious reasoning process that kind of makes that happen, but.
And suddenly Twitter becomes just a massive outrage off and everybody's furious about something.
Yeah, the outrage machine of Twitter. I love a bit of Twitter, but oh really? Like, there's just that bit of it is just like, we really don't have any original thoughts in our heads, do we? Just the people who we follow, literally we follow.
I love the stuff when you get to the point of the fury about sort of films or books, and the people who always begin, I haven't seen it, but, and you think, well,
if you haven't seen it, then stop talking about it.
Yeah. I'm still going to get angry. Don't you worry. But yeah, so I quite
actually,
like
I feel at this point, Matt, I should make a confession, which is that I didn't actually watch Scrooge last week. I just made all of that anger up.
You just saw it on Twitter.
Just saw it on Twitter, and I was like, oh, fuck him. Bill Murray, fuck him.
Yeah, please share if you agree.
Yeah. Retweet. Did better than retweet. Re-ranted. Oh yes.
Yeah, so that's the sheep mentality of kicking the crap out of a sexton. And we move on to, they show him another scene. They start to show him a series of other scenes. And the only other one we see with him is this this just sunny field and like a really idyllic summer's day in the countryside. And again, Gabriel's like, yeah, that's nice. They're basically showing him all the good things that he's been ignoring in his sort of miserable outlook on life. And it's just his sort of his personal view that everything is just rubbish.
Yeah, and kind of presenting him with the like the implication of that. Because it's very easy to just be like, oh, it's all rubbish, I don't like it, this is shit. Yeah. But it's like, well, you still live in the world where that's true, so this is how it affects you.
Yeah.
Kick, punch, gouge.
Yeah, because every vision is followed up by some more physical beating as well, just for the hell of it. And it was interesting that the King of the Goblins says something. It's not just about being nice for the sake of it, or being good-natured or pleasant or optimistic for the sake of it. He basically makes a point claiming that the people who have that kind of optimistic outlook are often the ones who are more resilient when things get tough, and that the people who think everything's crap anyway and are miserable are the ones who get crushed more easily than any others.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Because you're starting from a low ebb, right? I think that's very, you know, I think that's almost demonstrably true, really.
Like, yeah.
You know, to a certain extent, the world is how you respond to it. To a certain extent, of course, that's not true. But, yeah.
I thought that goes well with the Goblin's character as well. You know, he isn't he isn't this benevolent, lovely creature who's trying to say, why should we, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could all be lovely? He's saying, you know, you're being a prick and your life's worse because of it. And you know what? There's actually a bit of power to be had in not being such a miserable fucker. So why don't you cheer up? Kick.
Do you know what, actually? I would absolutely love a kind of an adaptation of this, or a Christmas Carol, but that would never happen because it's seen as a kid's thing. But something like that, where you get a proper sort of Ray Winston as the Goblin King. Do you know what I mean? Listen to me, you ugly fucker. Cheer the fuck up. You're round your ass. Do you know what I mean?
You're acting like a mug.
A fucking mug. And the odds are that in the next 10 minutes... I'll be having you.
Yeah. So there's a series of other visions, and we leave Gabriel there, and we skip forward a bit to when he wakes up in the graveyard, bottle of drink in hand, and he thinks, oh, maybe I just dreamt it all. Maybe I just got wrecked and dreamt it all.
Overdone it a bit.
Yeah. And then he tries to stand up, and he's just aching all over from bruises from being beaten up by these goblins. So the physical effects are still there as a reminder that this is actually, you know, is true, he thinks.
Mm.
Do you think it is true? Or do you think he did just have this crazy dream and just fell off a gravestone and banged his head?
Well, since I didn't do the subsidiary reading for this week's podcast in reading the whole of the rest of the Pickwick Papers, I don't really know. There's a bit of me that's like, I kind of want it to have been real. But if I can't see, unless the whole book is like a series of fantastical episodes like this, I can't see how it would be, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a bit, I don't know, I'm a bit sad by that, but...
I very much read it as it was real, and this is the evidence for it. And the strange thing is, he then decides, he's a changed man, he says, and he decides to, he can't bear the thought of seeing people in the village who he'd been nasty to and who'd got this reputation. So he just leaves. He just drops his stuff and leaves and runs away to almost start again.
Well, I tell you what's interesting about this is that this is what we said, isn't it, about the Scrooge just experiencing this metamorphosis and everybody going along with it. You know, he never worries once that everybody's going to be like, who the fuck are you? No, go away. You're that horrible man.
Yeah.
He just assumes that everybody's going to be all right with it. Whereas actually this time like he actually goes, no, I'm not going back there. Fuck it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And the interesting thing is here, when he disappears, everybody like in the village they find the overturned lamp and the bottle and a kicked over gravestone, which again is, I suppose, further evidence of the goblins jumping over him. And and they immediately assume he's probably been carried away by goblins. So is this sort
so
of
you've got to ask questions, haven't you, about law enforcement in this town, where somebody disappears and the first thing anybody says is goblins?
Yeah, the only other possible explanation that is offered up is maybe he was carried away by some kind of bear horse monster who just turned up.
And I love that they say it did happen because look, something's been knocked off the top of the chimney. There it is, the bear horse monster knocked it off the chimney. There's a piece of stone there, and that means that bear horse monsters definitely exist and we're definitely here. Yeah.
I read this this book of ghost stories from Delaware when I was over there, because it's the oldest state in the US.
And,
it was a collection of ghosts, and some of them were quite good, and some of them were just absolutely ridiculous. And one of them was something like, it was this creature that was seen wandering around in the dark in the near a swamp, and no one got a good sighting of it. It was sort of man sized. and was running around, and they said maybe it was, you know, somebody wandering around, or maybe it was a slime monster. I was like,
seems legit.
Why would you immediately jump to that?
Could have been a
man-sized figure wandering around. It's either the town drunk or it's our previously unknown, I've unseen monster from the depths of the swamp.
I was going to say that, isn't it? It is. Mm. Or it's either a man hammered with his clothes off wandering around in the dark. Or Swamp Thing. could be either.
Yeah. Well, the prevailing view in this village is that the sexton has been taken away and eaten and sort of never to return by some kind of monster, which this belief is damaged somewhat 10 years later when he just turns up and he comes back to the village.
I love that line. His belief was damaged somewhat.
And he comes back and says he's basically been wandering around as a bit of a hermit, hasn't he, for the last 10 years. And he says he's a changed man, and he realizes that he was in error when he was the miserable old gravedigger.
And you astonish me. I was amazed.
And the final point that Dickens makes is around that, isn't it? Sort of no point, basically no point being miserable. Find the exact quote to finish it off. He says, it's quite a convoluted way of making the point, but he says, the story has one moral, if to teach no better one, and that is that if a man turns sulky and drink by himself at Christmas time, he may make up his mind to be not a bit the better for it, let the spirits be never so good, or let them be ever as many degrees beyond proof as those which Gabriel Grubb saw in the Goblin's Cavern. What's that? A little morality tale, kind of, for Christmas. And you can see the parallels, can't you, with A Christmas Carol. And it's sort of, I think Dickens took this and thought, you know what, there's more to do with this. And there's a bigger story you could tell, and a more ambitious one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, again, you can kind of see it being a bit of a work for hire thing, isn't it? Where he's like, I mean, it's very, very well written, but you can almost hear him going, all right, deadline's Wednesday and it's Monday morning. Ghosts, goblins. I haven't done goblins recently. What shall I do? Oh, I tell you what, they're going to show somebody the error of his ways. Yes, Charlie, son, you're a genius. Here we go. You know.
I thought
that he just writes it out and then realises that he's sort of thrown away a pearl in 1,500 words that he really should have made a book out of.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun little sort of tasty little morsel of a story. And, you know, you can read it within sort of 20 minutes and, you know, it does a decent, you know, it's not going to change your life, but it's a fun little story.
Oh, yeah, it's good. And between this and A Christmas Carol, I'm feeling a lot more well-disposed towards Charles Dickens than I was before. Maybe I will even go and try reading David Copperfield. Maybe I'll try that.
Well, that is quite a big read.
Yeah, that is quite a big read. Maybe we won't do it on the podcast because it'll be another Game of Thrones special where we do it for 6 months or something.
Yeah, I mean, if one of the things you like about The Christmas Carol and The Goblins Who Stole a Sexton is brevity, then you may be disappointed with David Copperfield.
You astonish me, Matt, really?
do you want to watch a couple of... Do you want to hear a couple of reviews?
I do, very much.
Before we finish off. One's from Katrina, who says... It's 2 stars. It says, possibly working up to the masterly A Christmas Carol, the goblins kidnap the gravedigger and make him watch Hallmark television. Okay, short story, but not real. No real meat.
Well, that's undeniable, isn't it?
Yeah. Catherine said, Dickens' earliest Christmas story about a gravedigger. I'm not going to use that one because she just basically says what the story is, which isn't much point of a review.
Slow hand clap there, I feel.
Yeah, this one's quite nice. Sarah, 4 stars, says, I liked both the plot and the writing. The story isn't perfect, but I feel like it being described as a story that people have been telling for ages, it's really well written, which makes it up for a bit that I can't complain at the moral of the story, because it's definitely a good one in my mind. So she's saying that because it's set as, I mean, it's set in the Pickwick Papers as one of the stories that people are just telling to each other. It's kind of told off the top of this character's head. So it kind of, when you put it in that context, it makes sense that it's fairly brief and fairly short and, I don't know, fairly fast and loose with detail.
Yeah, totally. It's very much a campfire story, isn't it? Or a kind of, you know, gather round, let me tell you a story. And, you know, when you write stories like that, if you ever tried to make up a story on the spot, it's absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
there's a reason why it's generally only done for kids, and that's because they're just really happy if you do funny voices.
Yeah.
At a certain age. But yeah, it really sounds fantastic to me as a sort of, it's a believable ad-libbed story, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's one that I think I'll go back to another Christmas as well. If I fancy, if the very short Christmas Carol is still too long for me, I'd give this a
call. So what you're saying is really, is if you get absolutely hammered on the Friday before and the last day of work, and you wake up the next morning wanting to get in the Christmas spirit, but you literally cannot face having your eyes open for that long, right? Then what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to read Gabriel Grubb.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll leave the last review for Jeanette. She says, a very quick read, all of 5 minutes. I'd just pull her up on that. I'd say it's a 5 minute quick read, or it's a sort of 15, 20 minute luxurious read, if you want to sort of take your time with it. And just,
like expensive soap.
Yeah, like good whiskey, if you want to just sip it. That's quite a nice way to do it.
Embarrassing that I went to expensive soap before whiskey there. Going to lose some of my street cred, I feel.
Actually, one thing, I read this, and I think this works, reading it out loud, because it's supposed to be a tale told in the vernacular anyway. I quite enjoyed I read it through, and then I read it through again out loud, which obviously looked fucking odd when I was sitting in there. but it was kind of cool, and I'd urge anyone who's got it just to give it a try, just read it out loud. Obviously, let other people in the house know what you're up to first, or...
Don't do that. Just walk around declaiming. Get your best Brian Blessed voice on and just shout it to the rafters. It'd be great.
Yeah. Or at the very least, what you must do is creep up behind somebody this Christmas season and just go, Gabriel Grubb, Gabriel Grubb. And see what they do.
That is a really obscure punk to try and do. Like, walk up to somebody and go, Ebenezer Scrooge, and they'll be like, oh, that's a bit weird. But you go up behind them and go, Gabriel Grubb, you will genuinely disturb them. You won't give them any Christmas cheer or change the way they look at things. They'll just be like, who the fuck are you, and who the fuck is Gabriel Grubb?
Anyway, sorry, Jeanette, I interrupted your review there. So we'll go back to it. She says, to round off our look at... The Goblins Who Stole a Sexton by Charles Dickens. Jeanette says, a very quick read, all of 5 minutes. If only man could be changed to kindness in one night as easy as this, then we would all seek out the goblins and not run from them. And with that, I mean, what a New Year's message to take in
there
to 2015.
From your friends at Shark Liver Oil, a New Year's message.
Yep. So hope you enjoyed this. Hope you had a great Christmas. Hope you got everything you asked for. Hope you didn't get a lump of coal in your stocking, unless you asked for coal. And
in which case, that's a bit weird.
Yeah, we're going to take a couple of weeks break now, but we'll be back in the new year, probably sort of mid-January, with a new book. And we're going to keep that one under wraps for now, not because we haven't decided which one we're doing yet. It's definitely not that.
Of course not. No, I don't know why you'd even think to imply that it might be.
No, it's because suspense is what it's all about. what we'll do...
Sales, Matt, sales.
What we'll do, and this is a Shark Liver Oil cast iron guarantee, is on New Year's Day, we will tweet the new book, which we're going to do officially.
You're volunteering?
Yes.
Excellent. Fantastic.
I've just realised I'm out of the country, so this could be tricky.
So am I.
Oh, we'll make
cast
it happen,
iron, but... ladies and gentlemen. Cast in iron.
Well, look, that's got to happen somehow, some way. I might have to find an internet cafe, but we'll tweet it then. Sometime on New Year's Day.
I believe you.
Yeah, look forward to that. Merry Christmas, everybody, and a happy New Year.